almost heaven. West Virginia, Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River. Life was old there, older than the trees, younger than the mountains, blowing like the breeze. Country road, take me home to the place where I belong. West Virginia, Mountain Mama, take me home. Country road.
You know, I love that song, Almost Heaven, West Virginia. Wow, it feels so good to hear that when you have been on the road. Hey, I am Michael T. George, your host here for My Story of America Radio. I have just returned from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, Hershey, Pennsylvania as well, visiting the Christian Home Education Association of Pennsylvania. Just had a great homeschool conference for 2 days up there visiting with some incredible people, doing book signings, speaking. And let me tell you, there were several things that I was just impressed with at the event. You know, it's always great to get out in there and go visit people, go meet people, go see just the ordinary folks that make up America. And let me tell you something. Let me share something with you that if you have never been to a huge homeschool event, you're in for a surprise if you go to one. You will be amazed at the diversity of educational choices out there. That's right, choices, opportunities, different methods, different ways, all different ways to teach your children. I mean, think about this. If you have your children in the public school, they have one way to learn math, whatever the government school wants to teach them. However, Common Core has decided this week that 2 + 2 = 5. Oh yeah, that's right, it doesn't equal 5. I forgot, yeah, it's really 4. But nonetheless, I mean, that's a different story for another day. But you can go and you can learn all these different methods, different ways, creative ways. Here's the great thing. In the homeschool community, they end up coming with up creative ideas to educate their children because you know what? Their children are different. And so they figure out, okay, what doesn't work for one might work for the other. And so they come up with all these creative ways, all these choices to successfully educate the youngsters of America. It is really great. It is so diverse. It is so interesting. Well, this week on My Story of America Radio, we are going to take an incredible journey. A journey back in time to a story that I would say many of you have never even heard of. One in which it will challenge you to really think about, who is this guy? Would I even want to have a part of him? Really? He did that? Yeah, those will be the questions, the statements you'll be making at the end of today's broadcast. Because we're going to take a journey through life and liberty, faith and freedom. Once again, we're taking a road down the backcountry roads, back overseas into England for an incredible story this week. So welcome, my friends, once again to My Story of America Radio. Life began quite normal for a young man whose father was a captain aboard a large English merchant vessel that sailed the Atlantic Ocean. In fact, John made his first voyage at the tender age of 11. John was strong, witty, and proved even at a young age to be an asset on the high seas. This was quite an important act and feat, because in the mid-1700s, when transatlantic voyages proved to be very treacherous, it was important to have a son that could handle himself aboard a merchant vessel. And by the time John had reached his late teens, he was a very valuable asset on his father's ship. The smell of the high seas, the feel of the wind whipping across the deck was like a sweet, savory meal to John. He loved the ocean and everything that embodied it. Nothing could keep his mind from pursuing a life spent traversing the world aboard a ship. Except, of course, possibly one person. A young girl, properly named Mary, but better known to John as Polly. She was just 13 years old when they first met, but Cupid's arrow had pierced his heart so powerfully that he was smitten from the very first look. However, there were major obstacles in the way. John, being 17 at the time, was actually scheduled to leave for Jamaica to become a plantation manager. Yes, his father had worked it out that he would go and work aboard this plantation and eventually manage the place, earning John a good living. He'd be gone for at least 4 or 5 years. But the pleasure of Polly's company actually kept John from making the scheduled appointment. John was only supposed to be visiting with Polly about a day or two, but 12, 13 days later, he was still there, and the ship sailed on without him. All the carefully laid out plans that John's father had done, the position he had worked, the things he had figured out so that John could be on the ship and work in the plantation, were now gone. John's father was furious, but John didn't care. It didn't matter to him. He was smitten, and he could think of nothing but his sweet Polly. As a penniless young man, now just 18 years old, John couldn't even think of courtship, let alone talk about it until his prospects for a proper livelihood would change. See, only a suitor with money or career prospects could even contemplate wooing the daughter of a respectable family in the 18th century. Unfortunately, John began to drift. He often took walks in and around the village of Chatham in England, where he lived. But in the spring of 1744, this was a dangerous pastime. England was on the brink of hostilities with France. And in fact, the English man of war ship, the Harwich, was there sitting in the port. This ship, this ship of war, was understaffed, greatly understaffed, and they needed sailors. And unfortunately, John would become their victim. One night, while he was out wandering the streets, not paying any attention, an armed press gang captured John. See, press gangs were used by the England's Navy to gather men, and they pressed them into His Majesty's service. It was basically a more brutal form of the draft. You had no choice. They came and physically took you away. John began to exclaim, "He cannot be taken. He can't be pressed into the Navy. He works on a merchant vessel with his father, who's the captain." Well, the men wanted no part of what John was saying. They got paid to get sailors. They did not care who he was or where he worked. John tried to fight back. But before he knew it, a large club came crashing down upon the back of his head, knocking him unconscious. John was now held on shore for about 3 days while the press gangs continued to gather other men, search for them, other guys that would be willing, quote, quote, soldiers, naval officers, not officers, of course, naval seamen, the lowest you could get in the Majesty's Navy. But John miraculously managed to get a letter to his father. John's father, the captain, pleaded with the officer of the press gang to release his son, but unfortunately it was to no avail. A fit young man with considerable seagoing experience was too valuable to release. So on that Sunday, John and about 8 other men were taken aboard the HMS Harwich, and his life as a Navy seaman in Royal Navy of England was about to begin. Now, John's abilities actually earned him a higher rank from the very beginning. Just 5 weeks later, when an official declaration of war with France was declared, John was actually appointed to be a midshipman, which was essentially the status of a sub-officer in training. However, for John, his behavior began to cause him serious issues. His arrogance and harshness to the ordinary seaman bred resentment. His taunting, his making fun of their position, and taunting his. The haughtiness he showed would later come back to haunt him in a very big way. After about 8 months at sea, John's ship was anchored in an area that would be just a short riding distance to the home of Polly. So John applied for a one-day pass, and it was granted. But John knew deep down it would take more than a day for him to ride to go see Polly and get back to the ship. However, he was young, impetuous, in love. It didn't matter to him. His romantic heart overruled his naval head. John was gone for about more than 12 days when he finally returned to the ship. And actually, it was more like 15 days. Needless to say, the captain was none too pleased. Some of John's fellow officers pleaded for leniency and told the captain, "He's young, he's impetuous, he's in love, cut him some slack." And so the captain did relent from a formal punishment, but he began to lose confidence in John. And this was not the only thing that was happening to John. Something devastating was about to take place in his life. John had been brought up in a home where his mother had read him scripture at an early age. In fact, she was quite a devout religious woman, instilling in John the principles of God. But John was beginning to lose his religious faith. His mind began to take a turn into strange atheistic thoughts. And the men around him, who were not religious as well, began to encourage that reckless thinking. Now, John's passion for Polly was relentless. And when John soon got word that the ship was going to head to the East Indies, which would mean a 5-year tour of duty for all those involved, John knew he could not make that trip. His chance at escape soon presented itself. John was placed in charge of the longboat that would leave the Harwich and go over to the shore to gather up supplies. And the captain gave John strict orders. "Make sure that no one escapes from your presence as you're loading supplies on the longboat. John, it's your responsibility to watch these men." John willingly agreed. But while the men were working hard, putting supplies into the boat, John took a gamble. He decided that he would leave. He would sneak away. He would go see Polly. He had to see her. He had to be with her. But his gamble went horribly wrong. John was arrested soon by some merchant marines. He was marched under guard into the city in a public shame. He now most certainly feared for his life, because desertion from the Royal Navy carried a death penalty. And if he was court-martialed and found guilty, he would be hanged from the yardarm of the ship. For those next 2 days, John was held in a military guardhouse until he was marched back to the ship and put in chains, awaiting his fate. Luckily for John, his father had heard about his incarceration, and he managed to get assistance so that his son would not be put to death. But unfortunately, he could not prevent what would happen next. John was brought on board the deck, and everybody else aboard the ship was also. They were all there to witness John's punishment. It was humiliating, and the shame of being publicly flogged before all your peers was most certainly devastating. He stood there, They stripped him down to his waist, tied his arms to the mast as a man with a whip moved into place. A nine-tailed whip of knotted ropes was used to inflict intense pain. The man got into position. He brought the full brunt of the whip across the back of John, time and time again. John's body buckled in agony with each exacting lash that was delivered. Every man on board had a front row seat for John's public humiliation. But it also served as a warning to the others not to try and escape. John received 8 dozen lashes. That is correct. If you can do math, that is, he was whipped 96 times. John spent 2 days in recovery. And then he was demoted to the lowest rank available, which was that of ordinary seaman. This meant all the privileges that he had before, the place on deck that where he used to sleep, they were now gone. He was now placed into the very lower decks where all the other men that he had harassed with them. He's now living with the men that he had made fun of, sleeping beside the men that he had been haughty to. Yes, do you think they took it easy on John? Not at all. They had a score to settle. And it was during this time that John's mind began to race. He began to fantasize about assassinating the captain. Then his mind turned to thoughts of suicide. And even worse, John had now officially declared he didn't believe there was even a God. He became an avowed atheist, and in fact, he also was becoming known as the most blasphemous man on the high seas. Daily, he would come up with new ways to curse the God that he didn't believe in, to blaspheme his name, and the filthy cursings coming out of his mouth made these hardened sailors even want to blush. John was becoming very mutinous. He was becoming a trouble aboard the ship. He was becoming somebody that was causing trouble daily. Months later, John was asleep in his hammock when one of the midshipmen tried to awake him. John didn't want to get up. He just ignored him. And so the man walked over, took a knife out, and cut the ropes on John's hammock, bringing John crashing to the floor. Angrily, John got up, hurt somewhat, and noticed all of his things being gathered up. Before he knew it, he was marched up onto the deck of the ship, where he found out he was going to be exchanged to another vessel. A new vessel would be where John would be. The captain told him, "Look, we've decided you're of no use to us. There's an old saying, it's better to get rid of bad rubbish than let it sit around and stink up the whole place. So I've decided to trade you. I've traded you to another vessel. They're giving me a man, I'm giving them a man. You will now be placed aboard the Guinea trading ship called the Pegasus. It's a simple trade. You're no longer in the Royal Navy, John. You're now going to be dealing in cargo. Oh yes, by the way, the cargo they carry, it's a human cargo. John, you're being traded to work aboard a slave trading vessel." Do you think John cared? What did he care? He was out of the Royal Navy, and he knew at some point he would probably be able to get back to England and see his dear Polly. So, John figured, hey, this is good fortune. And in fact, it did turn out to be good fortune, because the captain of the Pegasus, Captain Guy Penrose, knew John's father. This would most certainly be to John's advantage. In fact, for the first several months of voyage, things were working very good for John. Until once again, he became distraught. He became disgruntled. He was tired of being at sea. He wanted to go back home. He wanted to go to England. He wanted to see Polly. And so he became a bad influence on the crew. And then he began to show open disrespect to Captain Penrose. John began to compose cruel lyrics designed to mock and deride the captain. John began living in open rebellion, not only to the captain, but most certainly at God. He hated being so far away from Polly, and he began to blame the God he did not even believe in for it all. John became blasphemous. He began to dabble a little bit in witchcraft. More and more, he became a terrible, wretched human being. John began to have a conversation on board the Pegasus with a man by the name of Amos Clow. And John had decided when he reached Africa, he was going to stay there. He would actually try his life at being a slave trader. Because Amos had talked to him and said, "Look, John, you're a young man. You could make a good living. There are 30 to 40,000 slaves a year being transported from America, from Africa to other parts of the world. Your fortune could be made." John decided, Yeah, I'm willing to be a player in this ruthless rush for wealth. So John knew, I'm getting full steam into the slave trading business. So once the ship arrived in Africa, Amos negotiated for the release of John into his custody. But unfortunately for John, his early career as a land-based slave trader proved to be a disaster. Oh, his overseeing skills were adequate, and he could control the slaves, but he had personal difficulties with Amos Clow's mistress. She was a black lady from a native tribe who assisted in the capture of other Africans to sell as slaves. In fact, she began to develop an immediate dislike for John. And when John came down sick and Amos had to leave on a journey without him, she said, "Don't worry, I'll take care of John." The princess, as she liked to be called, soon as Amos left, she began withholding food and water from John. He only received leftover scraps from her dirty plate, and his condition began to deteriorate. As he began to get frail, she laughed at him. And just to stay alive, John would have to sneak out every night and dig up raw roots from the ground. He ate them uncooked. This caused periods of vomiting and diarrhea, yet John kept eating them. In fact, he probably would have even died if it wasn't for the fact that some of the slaves took pity on him and they brought him portions of their meager rations and left him outside his door. When Amos finally did return, John was accused of being a thief by the princess. Unfortunately for John, he took her side. And subsequently, he was put in chains, given the lowest possible rations available, which was only one pint of rice a day. John was beaten daily. And in fact, Amos was determined to punish him as cruelly as possible. If John hadn't been able to sneak out at night and actually secretly catch some fish, he would have most certainly died. John had just reached 21 years of age, and he knew escape from this plantation was futile. His only hope would be to try and smuggle a letter to his father, letting him know where he was, about his whereabouts. John managed to smuggle his letters aboard the slave trading vessels that came in. He also sent forth letters to Polly, expressing his enduring love to her and letting her know where he was. John's life had most certainly turned for the worse. You are listening to My Story of America Radio here on the Veritas Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael T. George, and I'm so glad that you are here with us today. We are listening to the story of John, a story that has great interest, great power, and one that will actually blow your mind when we get into the next segment. It is one that when you sit back and you look at his life, you will think, wow, how did he end up here? Don't go away, my friends. This is My Story of America Radio here on the Veritas Radio Network. Radio the way it should be. We'll be right back.
What you've just heard is the reality missing from reality TV. My Story of America. We'll be right back on the Veritas Radio Network's Crusade.